Welcome to What the 50 podcast with Hazel Englander. I'm a classic Vogue model based here in London, and this is the antidote to ageism. Each week I interview women in their 50s from all walks of life about how positive, fun and youthful 50 actually is. Today I'm very at home in my own industry with Maria Warwick. Hi Maria.
Hi Hazel.
Hi Maria. Maria has had a very long and successful career, spanning lots of decades, and originally started off with Models One Elite. For anyone who doesn't know, this is the world's leading model management company, an icon of the industry. Representing the likes of Naomi Campbell, Linda Evangelista, Gisele Bündchen, and recently Kendall Jenner. Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hazel.
So, tell me, how did you get into Models One Elite? I mean, this really is impressive.
Well, in those days, there weren't that many agencies. There's probably about four or five really good agencies. I mean, they've proliferated now. So it was just a kind of a straightforward, I think they had casting times when they would see new recruits. And I just went in there, but I'd already met because I'd been modelling part time when I was a student at Liverpool, and I'd met Terence Donovan, and he'd sort of been pushing me to go into Lorraine Ashton, but I kind of for some reason preferred Models One. I think it was kind of big news at the time, so I sort of took myself in there, but I was armed with some photographs that he'd hand printed, so I think I had a little bit of an advantage.
And did they ask you who did the shots?
I think they knew.
So he had his trademark, because of course Donovan, to anyone, I mean, huge global name, but also behind, was he behind all, he wasn't behind Habitat and things, was he? Was he behind that as well?
Behind the what?
No, was he related to the Donovan that did all the Habitat shops and the
Bibendum? I don't know. No, I really don't know. I mean, he did a lot of huge campaigns and advertising-wise, and he did, obviously the Vogue and, the top-end magazines. For people who don't know, he was part of what they called the Black Trinity.
Oh, interesting.
And that was Bailey, Donovan and Duffy. And I think they were the 60s trio that were quite social.
I was thinking along the terms of Saatchi. I thought maybe they were related, like a Donovan dynasty, but of course Terence Donovan was the famous photographer, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, Terence Donovan was he was actually the son of a Mile End lorry driver.
Oh really?
Yeah. He was the first in that kind of business in his family, I believe.
And of course, in those days, everything was hand printed, wasn't it? And he'll have developed them himself. There was no such thing as digital. Skills involved really were down to the photographer. Whereas now, I feel whether it's the music industry or photography, if you're good at computers, you can basically be a photographer, be a musician, be anything. But in those days, it was different, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, totally, yeah. I think it's a completely different art now. You know, I spoke to a hair and makeup artist, because obviously I left the business a while ago, but I spoke to a hair and makeup artist who's still in it, and he said basically he was looking at a photographer setting up his lighting and couldn't believe how appalling it was. Because you don't really need to even have good lighting on set, because you can digitalize it and make it look right anyway. So I think it's just a totally different art now.
It really is. And as you say about lighting was key for everything, because I think you and I, our careers, we crossed over and we were both booked for quite a lot of trips, weren't
yeah.
we? We went to beautiful locations. But now, would you agree that models with the digital backgrounds available, they're probably not getting the breaks we did get?
I think it's a lot harder now, because I think that like I say, there was very much fewer models. We came along, you and I, before the advent of the supermodels. There were obviously names like Christy Brinkley it was such a long time ago. But, I think that poured a lot more people into the business, and then it became more celebby. And I think for people who worked all the time like we did, I think they've really been pushed out by celebrity. I used to do a lot of catalogue as well, and hence a lot of trips. And you know, and sort of a general catalogue trip would be a 2-week trip with 4 models, or a 3-week trip. Then they reduced it to 2 weeks, 10 days, 1 week, and the models got reduced. So now they end up just flying one model out for 3 days and use her and then use another. So I think it's a lot harder to get the volume of work that was around when we were doing it. It's a lot more competitive. The fees dropped through the floor. You know, for an average day, you know, I would say 20, 25, 30 years ago, for a catalogue shoot, you'd get £1,000, but I don't think they get that now. I don't even know if catalogue shoots are still on or it's all just online shopping. It's
online, isn't it? And different backgrounds. Yeah. I mean, why take a whole crew over to Florida or Orlando or Spain even? I mean, we used to go to Spain quite a lot, didn't we? With, was it Grattans or something? Yeah. Was it Gorka or Marbella we used to go to?
We used to go to Marbella quite a lot in the beginning.
I remember moaning about, oh, not Marbella again.
Yeah, I know. And it was really quite nice because the weather always seemed to be good, except one memorable trip when it rained every single day for 10 days. And so we couldn't shoot a thing. And actually, Belinda was on that trip. And
mutual friend.
It ended up with Belinda and Freddie becoming part of the floor show for the hotel because... Right. They just practiced these dancing routines and everyone was sitting around in the rain at this hotel in somewhere hideous like Torremolinos, and out they came on stage and did a dance routine.
Oh, brilliant. I think we've got this mutual friend, Belinda, who's very much, very fun. I mean, great fun girl, but quite eccentric and out there. And I think she learned belly dancing on one of my trips and she was up on stage doing that at some point. Yeah. But you originally started off, just rewinding now, you have an English literature and language degree and you're a convent girl. Talk to me about your academic career.
Oh, well, my academic career, if I started talking about it, people who are contemporaries of mine at university would probably start sniggering because I really didn't apply myself very well to my studies. I did love English at A level, and then when I got to university, I thought it was an excuse to have a lot of fun and reward myself for working hard at A level. And there was a fantastic group of people there at Liverpool at the time, and we've strangely just reunited recently. But it was more like partying and trying to avoid as many lectures and tutorials as I possibly could. But it was weird because it's that thing of having to study rather than doing it for the love of it. And then I think when I came out the other end of university, I started to enjoy literature a lot more again. But what I was doing was I was doing my studies, supposedly, but I was also going out and modelling. So it was actually quite a nice balance. I liked having the two things because one obviously was not really mentally challenging and the other one should have been.
So when you're doing one, you're agonising about the other, and when you're doing the other, you're agonising about what you should be doing on your course.
Well, it was kind of really complimentary. I just used my modelling money to have a little car at university, so I'd tootle around and you know, just sort of, it's more like spending money really. So, but it was actually really nice because, you know, obviously at university it could be quite intense in one way, and so it was nice to have a bit of freedom and, you know, freedom of movement. I'd go down to, and I actually didn't really like modeling at the time from the perspective of being a student, just because it seemed a very fakey world, no one seemed real. Everyone seemed to pay each other false compliments and things, and I couldn't actually really work it out. So I was probably quite judgmental of it at the time. However, I ended up going into it. So,
well, I think this is where you and I connected all those years ago, because we both found it quite difficult, didn't we, from that point of view. And I think now it's a bit more down to earth, in the sense that Storm, who I keep in touch with, give these little guidebooks out now to their models about mental health, eating habits, self-esteem, accounts. In those days, apart from motherhood, I don't know any other career you get thrown into with no guidance whatsoever. You just literally, you look the part, get on that catwalk, you know, get in front of that camera, and they just presume you've got the personality to go with it. But you just happen to look a certain way. It doesn't mean you know what you're doing. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I do agree. And I think it's sort of a, in the one way it was a learning curve, but I, like I said, I think it was a lot simpler back then. You know, this was the world before technology and before emails and before mobile phones. And I'm making it sound very prehistoric now. But, you know, and so it was actually, I didn't find it that hard, you know, because it seemed like a much smaller industry. It was international, but it didn't seem, I mean, everyone was getting on planes and traveling to locations and doing all that kind of thing. But it was very much, you know, I don't think the pressures were on the girls that there are now because of social media. You know, I think they need lessons in self-esteem and things like that. Whereas I don't think that it was quite as prevalent as it then as it is now. I think it's harder. I think it's harder all around because of the volume of models, because the fees aren't as good. You know, we bought our own houses, you know, within 2 or 3 years of
I know.
Flat, 2 or 3 years of modelling. And, you know, it was a very different game. I'm not sure I'd want to go in it now. I can't see the rewards in it unless you're a celebrity.
Would you agree then that now with Instagram, just everybody has the same pressures as we used to have in our little microscopic world? Now it's spread out, hasn't it? I mean, Instagram, you've got young girls, 17, 18, younger, worrying about what they look like, what their outfits are. All the pressures of a model really are out there for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's true. I think that, you know, the world is, that sort of parochial world has been smashed to pieces by things like Instagram. I think there's a place for it, but I think it's what you knew in modelling very quickly was it was a false reality. You know, people show themselves at their best. They had a team of hair and makeup and lighting and all that kind of thing to make them look good. Whereas now people can do it on their own and they can sell a dream or a lifestyle or an image that isn't actually reality. And so I think that's probably why people have a lot more difficulty adjusting to what
I agree. And the thing is, Maria, in those days, I mean, I remember having a great big spot that came up the night before I was doing a cover. It was only like Woman or Woman's Own or something. But even so, you know, I had this sort of boil following me around. People starting to ignore me and address the boil. You know, it was really bad. And of course, I had the perfect skin. I had perfect skin every other single day, minute of the week until the night before. Whether it was stress, I don't know. But the makeup artist had to deal with that. There was no editing, there was no retouching. And I went on that cover, and if you looked hard enough, you could see that they'd just plastered it with makeup.
And made it into a freckle or something. Yeah.
I gave it its own Instagram page now, wouldn't they? You know, the Boyles page or something, yeah. But it was quite brutal, wasn't it, emotionally as well in those days? I mean, how did you survive? You sound like you're so confident, you didn't take it terribly seriously, you made some money from it, you bought a car, you're at uni. It's a great attitude. How did you survive and how did you get this refreshingly normal attitude?
Well, I never found it really that brutal, Hazel. I mean, I had quite a strong idea of what I wanted to get out of it. And so I had goals, if you like. So it was quite goal-oriented. And I knew it was a well-paid job. In those days, people really didn't expect to be modelling outside of their 20s. So I knew it was a short-term job. So I knew I had to make a lot of money pretty quickly. And so I think not in the forefront of my mind, but in the back of my mind, I loved the idea of traveling all over the world. I loved the idea of making huge amounts of money without having to work too hard and all of that kind of thing. So I think if you have a family background, I mean, you know, my brothers and sisters never even imagined doing something like that, and so there was a lot of ribbing about it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I couldn't really take the whole thing seriously, because my background isn't from that sort of ephemeral world. And so there's a part of me, and also, you know, the student life and you know, the reality of that kind of world, you know, it was a sort of a collision. So I didn't really ever find it that brutal, because I had an idea of what I wanted to do, and I was quite professional about it, because I wanted to get the next job and the next job. So I would go to a job with the view that I wanted these clients to book me again. So I had quite a commercial attitude to it rather than a dreamy attitude to it.
Very intelligent attitude to it, and that's the instrumental way attitude that works, isn't it, to treat it like that.
Yeah, of course. It's, you know, what is it? It's not you know, it's a means to, it's a job, you know, yeah. it's not a vocation, if you like, you know, it's not, you can only get certain things out of it. And so, you know, I was probably quite mercenary about it, but at the same time, I did really start to enjoy it. And strangely enough, I didn't really enjoy it at the top end of the industry. I started to enjoy it the most when I started doing a lot of catalogue work, which at that point was really looked down on. You know, it wasn't like, oh, that's commercial. There's commercial as opposed to editorial, but actually that was the most fun of all. And so I maybe didn't have the same attitudes to it that people had. Of course I had dreams, you know, it would have been lovely to be on the cover of Vogue and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, when you enter that world, having come from a pretty normal background, you look at it and think, I'm not so sure it's actually really what it says it is. It's not what it says on the tin.
And can you, for our listeners, explain what you mean between editorial and commercial modelling, please?
Yeah, editorial is all the magazine work and the, you know, high-end work that is highly thought of. So things like Vogue and Elle and Glamour and Harper's, and they're still around, I don't know. And the commercial work would be basically the work where you earned a lot of money. So that would be, you know, advertising companies, catalogue companies, and they would be using models, you know, clothing companies, basically shops, you know, like Topshop, River Island, whatever, Marks and Spencers, all those places that sell clothes want to use models.
And they
would pay more.
Earn the money, didn't they? I mean, that's where the money was, you know, wearing those long, scratchy nylon 90s in LA, you know, bought us flats in London, whereas Vogue paid 40 quid because everybody was queuing up to get into these magazines like Vogue and things. I mean, would you agree that you have to do the editorial, high prestige, visual stuff that everybody used to see on the bookstands and posters, whatever, to get the well-paid, less status, if you like, but the better paid catalogue jobs?
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, you have to have a good book. So to get a good book, you really, you know, portfolio, you needed to have the right pictures in it. So, and you have to present yourself, you know, you're a commodity as a model. So you have to present yourself as looking as desirable for whatever advertising or campaign or catalogue it is. So, you know, because you're selling a dream, or you were selling a dream, you know, an idea. So it was, you know, from that aspect, that's what I mean by saying it's not a reality. It's not a real world. It's actually just an ideal world, an idealized world. So, yes, your portfolio had to be as high end as it possibly could be, because then everyone would go, oh, I want my customer to identify with that kind of image.
So you'd show them Donovan as a casting, and then they'd stick you in a sort of floral frock for, you know, the masses. But that's really what happened, isn't it? Or what still does happen. Models can come along with your Donovan shots, fantastic shots, but it's the clients with the money and perhaps the less salubrious outfits that will grab onto that and pay you a fortune to try and emulate it.
Yeah, I don't think they'd be trying to emulate Donovan in the catalogues, but I think Donovan would be telling him he's great if he hears this podcast. The idea would be that, you know, then it's, I think that, well, there's obviously a disconnect between the sort of catalogue work I did to the high-end glamorous stuff, but yes, that would be the idea. You're selling a dream, you're selling a lifestyle, which is the same principle as I suppose it is now, isn't it? You know, they
totally but you did, I mean, you're being very modest here, because I do know that you did shoot Italian Vogue, didn't you? Would you say that's fantastic? I mean, really prestigious. Talk me through that one.
Well, it was just another shoot. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it was funny. It was great. Kudos to get it, and that was lovely. But again, I was thinking more about, oh, these pictures will be really good because I can use them and then I can monetize it. I sound like the most mercenary person on earth, but I wasn't. But I think I'm just looking at this in a nice way. No, it was nice to get the prestigious thing. I would like to have got more prestigious work, but that didn't happen. And So, well, no, it did, but not, you know, I don't think you can have a long career if you're just doing editorial. You have to translate it into something else, or you did in those days. Now, I think the difference between then and now is that really it's not really model driven, it's celebrity driven, is the business of selling products.
True. And we've become celebrity obsessed, haven't we? So I remember doing tons for people like Weller, Schwarzkopf. I don't know whether you did all that hair stuff as well. They were very lucrative jobs, you know, almost on a weekly basis. Made a lot of money from that. Now they just use Cheryl Cole, you know, and you think you haven't got hope of getting that. The models.
No, I don't know. That's what I think. I think the whole business is different. You know, it's different from the point of view that it's digitalized, so you don't have the same shoots going on. You know, I used to come back from location shoots with bags and bags of film that I was supposed to not allow through the x-ray machine so the whole shoot didn't get ruined. Yeah. And of course, that is a very different world now. And, you know, the models like us who were working and earning a lot of money, they don't exist anymore because they've handed all those big campaigns and things over to celebrities.
Absolutely. And they're all retouched and don't look real, and the skin is drawn in on the computer. It's just not... It's terrifying, actually, because we're all looking like memes instead of real people. So,
well, yeah, there's a funny crossover, isn't there? So it's just a totally different... Well, it's moved on. The world has moved on. That world has moved on. It's not something I really recognise anymore. You know, when in the last couple of years, I was working as a casting agent in a very part-time way. And, you know, it was quite an eye-opener how different it is, that world.
That leads me on to my next question, actually, because you were a booker, weren't you? For which agency were you a booker for?
Yes, I did do some booking for Bookings Men. Sorry, go on.
You were working for Bookings, which is the name of an agency, because I was with Bookings years ago as well. You were there as a booker for the men's division. How different was it being on that side of the industry?
Well, the thing, it was very different. I mean, I was actually still modelling at the time as well. And I got the job to train as a booker because I was always looking to what I was going to do next, because my most comfortable was actually being a student and modelling, because it was nice having, you know, a dual thing going on. And I was always looking to the end game in modelling. It's just the end game went further and further into the distance because models started to get older and older acceptably. And so my career just sort of prolonged itself. But I was always looking for something else. So a friend of mine, who's still a friend, trained me up as a booker. I was glad to be in the men's division because I didn't really want to be still modelling and actually booking female models. So it was quite a humbling experience, actually, because it's about... You know, people, the male models would not perceive you as anything other than somebody who worked at a desk, which was a bit of a shocker. And you know, they were great guys, actually, really, really lovely guys. I can't think of one that was a total pain in the neck, but they were quite demanding, and they were, you know, the ones that were successful were very professional about it. But it was kind of like going invisible, which was. A bit of a shock to the ego.
What's the most exotic location you've ever worked on?
Oh gosh, exotic. Well, I've been to so many places.
How about listing the places you were fortunate enough to see? You said you love traveling the world. You use it instrumentally to see the world. What places have you seen that you feel you might not have gone to on holiday?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Arizona was the first trip I ever did, and I absolutely loved it. I would never have thought of going to a place like Arizona, but we actually traveled all around the states, from the state from Phoenix up to Four Corners via Flagstaff, and then down to Nogales on the Mexican border via Tombstone City. And it was just an amazing, amazing trip. I thought all trips were like that, but they're not, actually. You don't get into Winnebago and spend a night in a town and then move on, which is what we did on that trip. But we saw the whole of Arizona, and it was just amazing. So that was somewhere I wouldn't have necessarily gone. Let me think. Well, Zanzibar was so we've gone from A to Z straight away. Zanzibar was probably the most exotic trip I ever did, but also the most horribly memorable because I broke my wrist on the trip. Had to get home. Yeah, that was quite an eye opener with Zanzibar, actually. It was especially when I broke my wrist. And
what did you see because outside of the shoot? Once you broke your wrist, I presume you were back in the reality of Zanzibar, not the 5-star hotel Zanzibar or the shoot.
Exactly.
So what
exactly? Well, you know, I'd fallen over in the shower, and we were in this place called Ras Nungwi, which was quite away from Stone Town, which is the main place in Zanzibar. And so we had to find a hospital, and it was a confrontation with the real world and the third world, because the hospital had no glass in the windows. There was just ragged curtains hanging out. The X-ray machine was about the size of a sitting room, and they didn't have any means of setting my wrist at all there. And the paddy diver had set it with a couple of twigs. He'd splinted it with twigs. And I was in absolute agony. And then I saw all the other people in this X-ray room waiting. And I spoke to some of them. And, they were talking about, I said, what happens when you break a limb? And they said nothing. So they basically didn't have any recourse to any medicine, like to set a wrist and put it in plaster. So they just waited for it to set on its own. I mean, it was just
so no shocking. No National Health Service, no I presume taxes to pay for it, or I don't know how that works, but that's third world corrupt country, really. I'm not saying they were corrupt, but you know, nowadays it's improved.
It was extremely primitive, and of course there'd been a storm, and so there was, you know, days of mobile phones and things, so there was some radio phone that had gone down because there'd been a storm, so we couldn't even get in touch with the mainland to get me off the island. And I ended up having to get a ferry with Warwick, which was terrifying, and then cross the tarmac and get on the British Airways plane with the bone unset and fly home and get it set in Kingston Hospital.
Presumably you're in agony.
I was in screaming agony. I've never been in so much pain in my life. Well, they gave me this thing that they said was a morphine tablet, but it was terrifying stuff. Actually, Warwick was being the person who was the guinea pig. He would try one of the pills. Yeah, Warwick's my husband. He was my boyfriend at the time. But he would try them. He didn't have any problem trying them. He's like the drugstore cowboy. And he would try them, and he didn't keel over, I would then have one. And
Maria, that's true love.
Yeah, well, no, I think he just quite liked taking medication. He didn't know what it was.
Oh yeah, I suppose. I mean, that can't have been that long ago then, really, or 90s, late 90s, 2000 maybe, I don't know, because...
We've been married for 20 years, so I think it was probably the mid-90s, yeah, mid-90s.
So that doesn't qualify as your most, your most exotic location. Is that your least glamorous location, or can you beat that?
No, I can beat that, because Zanzibar was pretty glamorous. You know, it was a beautiful island. It
of course.
It was fairly primitive, but the least glamorous would be Southport Beach in the winter with the sea out. It was very unglamorous and freezing cold. And
this was a reshoot for
some catalogs, and that was all. Sorry, it's breaking up a little bit. Can you hear me, Hazel?
Yeah, we'll just have to bear with it, because we're shooting this during coronavirus, so everybody's on Wi-Fi, so we do have these occasional little blips. It's okay to stop, and then are you there?
Okay, yeah, no, I'm here. Good.
Great.
It was just breaking. No, so I was actually doing a reshoot for some catalogue work, and the photographer luckily had a very good sense of humour, because we just drove this big sort of white van with the clothes in onto Southport Beach, and the wind was howling and freezing cold. And they were pretty, thin dresses, crinkling dresses. Oh. And so in the end, I said, look, I can't bear to keep going in that van and getting changed. Can I just put another dress on top of this one? And so we did. So I just, somehow it looked all right. The windshield was actually the van. So I was standing about 2 inches away from the wing mirror, putting more and more clothes on as he took the photographs. And they didn't actually turn out too bad. But it was very unglamorous. So
it must have been quite thin garments, though. You would have gone up about 3 sizes by the end of the shoot.
I don't know how. Maybe we stood me sideways. I can't really remember. But I do remember it being miserably cold and extremely unglamorous.
Well, anyone that doesn't know Southport Beach, it's just outside Liverpool, isn't it? It's northern, northwest. Winter, it blows. And also, isn't it famous now for is it Anthony Gormley's sculptures that are on Southport Beach?
That's right, it is, yes. Yeah. Yes.
To the big life-size, well, larger-than-life human sculptures in the shape or form of Anthony Gormley, the sculptor. And I remember they were supposed to come down, but they're so incredible that they've kept them, haven't they?
So yeah, I believe so. Yeah, it's true.
So what you went to a faith school, you went to a convent, didn't you? And I was quite surprised to hear that it was Sister Pamela who won a modelling contract for you, or won one for herself.
It wasn't a nun called Sister Pamela, it was actually my Sister Pamela. Yeah, no, Sister Pamela did not.
I'm wondering if the sisters are entering modelling competitions.
Sister
Pamela. Okay.
An excommunicatable convent. Pamela, my sister, won a modelling competition. And so I decided to tag along as well and do it. She didn't want to do it at all. It's because she looked like a model. You know, she was 6 foot. She had silvery blonde hair. But she always wanted to be a PA. And so we'd entered this Lucy Clayton competition, and I got nowhere in the modelling side of it. And she was in the finals of the secretarial side, because Lucy Clayton had a grooming side, a modelling side, and a secretarial side. It was sort of like, you know, a very old style thing.
It was a sort of like finishing school, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was like a finishing school. So anyway, so Pamela got in the finals, and then, much to my dismay, she didn't win the finals of the secretarial bit, but they offered her a modelling course because they thought she should be a model. So I was then furious, and having got nowhere in the modelling sector. And so I thought, right, well, we could both do it together. So we did. We did this course at Lucy Clayton in Manchester. And it was kind of a lot of fun. Pamela hated it, and I didn't particularly like it. I think it was well weird. But and it was very old-fashioned as well, because even in those days, they were teaching us how to walk down the catwalk, doing what they called the old Paris turn and the new
Paris turn. If you can visually just explain what the old Paris turn would involve.
Well, I can't remember at all. I mean, I think I must have blanked it out deliberately. But it felt old-fashioned even then.
You're not learning that. Yeah. So, yeah. But you did start off at a convent school, didn't you? And you were at Lark Hill Convent School in Preston. What was it like going from a convent education via Liverpool University, admittedly, which again has 2 cathedrals in it, but into an industry which isn't really synonymous with ethics, morals, that kind of behaviour? I'm not saying it's not a moral industry, but you know what I mean? It's a cutthroat, difficult industry. Yes. And you're a convent girl. How did that work?
Well, the thing is, I was only at the convent in the sixth form, and I'd been at a comprehensive school before that. So it wasn't like I was sort of I wasn't in any sort of cloistered life. I kind of wanted to get out of the convent as quickly as possible, because I absolutely hated it. I shouldn't really say, because now we know the name of the convent, but I didn't really like it, and I just used it as a means to try and scrub up on my academic work, which had sort of suffered a bit by going to the comprehensive because no one really cared there. And there was the good thing about the convent, I will say, is there was a definite academic ethic that I hadn't experienced at the comprehensive school. And so it was good to, you know, it basically enabled me to go to university because I had to pull my socks up. I was probably quite rebellious at that point. So convent life didn't really suit me. And so it wasn't a hard move into modelling because I was doing anything to flee the convent environment, which I did by going to be a student. So it was not really a transition that was, you know, straight from convent to a fashion world, which would be, you know, I get what you're saying, it would be like a complete anathema. It was, you know, obviously I was brought up as a Catholic and I'm still a practicing Catholic, so it wasn't really a big shock to go into modeling. Because I wasn't
it sounds like you have the sort of brain that can apply this format to everything, whether it's the convent, whether it's university, juggling that with work, modeling. It sounds like you're just very level-headed, down-to-earth girl who knows what she wants and has been quite instrumental about it. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's very nice of you to say so. I mean, I suppose I don't know. Yeah, I suppose I am quite level about things. I don't really like my feet leaving the ground. I don't feel comfortable. It's a comfort zone, really, that I'm quite practical and pragmatic. And, you know, I had a dream about modelling, obviously, when I was a young girl, before I started modelling, and thought I'd love to be in that world. And, it was a world that was, it was actually really a very pleasant world at the time. I didn't find it brutal or challenging, but I suppose there's a toughness in me that, you know, maybe it was part of my family growing up. You know, we were quite brutal with each other as a family, actually. So it wasn't hard going into modelling. And, you know, I had a very secure family unit and a very happy family unit and, you know, a very, very sort of, I don't know how would you call it, Preston, you know, where I grew up was a very grounded town. So, you know, my background was not that flighty. You know, it was easy.
You probably didn't realise how much that was helping you at the time. Because if you hadn't come from something like that, maybe you would have noticed some of the harder aspects of the industry, tougher aspects emotionally of the industry. But can I extract any sort of juicy stories or interesting stories about prima donnas that you've met? Not naming them, but just shoots that you've done, disasters that have happened, funny little stories from your career.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I can't really think of any prima donnas. Let me think. Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had in the shoots abroad. We used to have tremendous fun, you know. Let me think of a story. I don't know. I mean, I used to visit my sister quite a lot in Hong Kong, which wasn't renowned as a capital of modelling, but I used to go there to have a lot of fun. And it just so happened there was an awful lot of work there at the time. So, and it was a bit of a fledgling business at the time in the sort of mid 80s. And so they used to get me to go into China to do a lot of work because the Chinese economy was starting to really latch on to the idea that there was money in fashion. And obviously a lot of garments are produced in China anyway. So I used to catch the bus from Hong Kong into the special economic region of China. And we'd have to go over the border on the it was just the local bus. It wasn't, you know, they didn't transport me there in any other way except public transport. And at the border, we had...
You didn't break anything?
No, what happened was that we were at the Chinese border. So you go all the way through Hong Kong, up into the new territories, and then onto the border. And at the border, we had to declare all our jewellery for some strange reason. Well, I didn't have a lot of jewellery at the time, but we had to itemise it and say how much it cost. And so I had to fill in this great big long form. And when I came out the other end, being the only blonde-haired white person on the bus, you'd think they wouldn't have forgotten me, but I saw the bus driving off without me.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, so I was left with all these very scary looking Red Army border guards and a big empty square with the bus disappearing around the corner. And I was thinking,
no mobile phone in those days.
No mobile phones in those days. So anyway, I saw this group of people and they were walking in a direction, these Chinese people. So I thought, well, I'll just follow them, because it was just this big empty space. And so I started following them, and this very sweet guy turned around and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm following you. And he said, we're going to the factory. now I'm really lost. And so he sort of managed to communicate what I needed to do. And I had fortunately got a brochure of this hotel I was supposed to go to, which was about an hour further down the road on the bus that had left me behind. And I showed him the brochure. He found the one taxi in town and put me in it and spoke to the guy, the taxi driver, who, you know, he must, in China, in Hong Kong, they call you Guailo, which means white devil. And I think he must have really thought he had a white devil in the back of the car, because we went like bat out of hell around every steep, scary corner of this sort of, you know, mountainscape to get to the hotel. So we did get to the hotel just as the bus driver was about to be torn apart by the client.
Were you terrified, Maria? I mean, no mobile phone, no internet, no nothing. You're literally in the middle of nowhere with nothing. I mean, our normal reaction now for our children would just be phone somebody, get a signal would be the biggest problem they had. But you're alone here. And you haven't got that brochure of a hotel.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really mind. I mean, I thought, well, what do I do now?
You weren't terrified.
I wasn't really terrified, but I thought, God, you know, I looked at the border guards and I thought, well, they don't look very friendly. I wonder if they'll let me through again and to get back to Hong Kong. But then I knew once I got onto the Hong Kong side, there was about 40 minutes of countryside before I got into Hong Kong and the MTR. So I thought, well, don't really know what I'm going to do, actually. I think I would have probably thought, well, maybe I'll ask them if I can make a phone call. I don't know, really. So that's sort of, basically, that's why I followed the Chinese factory workers got lucky.
And you nearly got yourself a shift at the local factory.
Exactly.
But you must have other stories of studio shoots with models throwing things around, or is that all just cliches that they didn't really happen in your career?
Well, I can't really remember anyone behaving badly, again, because the bulk of my work was money work. And if you behave badly, you wouldn't stay on the shoot. You know, I mean, we'd go on location, and obviously the last night on any location trip was a heck of a lot of fun, and because we'd all go off and get completely pie-eyed, and actually one of the times with a particular crew I used to go with quite a lot, the photographer overshot the runway before the last night, and he had to lie on a low wall while his assistant took the pictures, because he had such a hangover he could not move. And so there was quite a lot of it was a lot of fun, you know. We had a great time. I mean, I remember going on a shoot to Barbados with this same crew, and the photographer they were sort of teaming it, so they had about a month shoot with models flying in for 2 weeks or a week at a time, and I'd just flown in and I was quite tired, but they were having some party around one of these big houses in Barbados that they'd hired to shoot in, so the photographer said he would give me a lift home, and he was a big Italian guy, and he was wearing a pink negligee and red lipstick and he was very hairy, and he drove me home across Barbados to my hotel, and then started saying that he really liked me, and I thought, I cannot take you seriously. You're wearing a pink negligee and you've got red lipstick on and you look very, very male. So there was just, it was kind of fun, a lot of fun. Hello, are you there, Hazel?
Yeah, sorry, it interrupted again. Sorry, it's just the Wi-Fi. Carry on.
Yeah. We had some really good crews, and it was more fun rather than trauma. You know, I didn't really see any spectacular tantrums from anybody. Everyone sort of quite well behaved, and it was more like drunken debauchery at the end of the shoot.
Sounds like fun. But going back on the travel theme, which seems to have gone through your life, in your domestic life, you've been married to Warwick, who was your then boyfriend. And I think he definitely passed the love test sampling the drugs for you when you broke your wrist. That's really pretty cool. And he's from New Zealand. You've been together for 20 years now. You recently took your twins on a lifetime trip to New Zealand. Tell me about that.
Well, we did. It was wonderful. Obviously, you know, we visited New Zealand a few times, and I went there years before I met Warwick, and loved the place. And so we went there for a month, and I went 30 years ago. I went for 3 weeks and ended up staying 9 months, and really fell in love with the country and wanted to stay there. And coincidentally enough, I ended up marrying a New Zealander, but that was a coincidence, I think. And so we went back there because obviously his parents are there and they're getting older. And so we decided to go there for about 4 or 5 weeks to see if it's a place we could ultimately live, because
that was the motivation for the trip then. That was the
Well, that and obviously visiting Warwick's parents. And it was kind of dreamy because I'd connected up with my friends. You know, I've got this posse of girlfriends from 30 years ago, and nothing really has changed. You know, 30 years passes, and
And they're in New Zealand. I mean, these are your girlfriends down in New Zealand.
Yeah. The sisterhood.
Just taps great back in there. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, I stayed with this lovely family. It was unlike any other modelling experience when I went to New Zealand to model 30 years ago, because I was billeted with a family who became like my family and sort of adopted me, thankfully. And, so it was actually like embedding into the real life there. And modelling was kind of very secondary. And so I had such fond memories. And then I hadn't really been back to Auckland because Warwick's from the South Island. And so we did a sort of 2-island holiday there in the summer. So we were in Auckland for half the time and down in South Island for half the time as well. And as you know, Belinda came along. And it was very good. But, you know, we have a daughter who's disabled. So we're looking at where we can be that is a safe place for her. We don't really think it's London. So that was sort of part of a motivation as well, to find a place where we could ultimately end up. But it was magical. It was a wonderful experience.
Okay. We'll go. So you were saying, you went all around New Zealand, you went to Auckland because Warwick isn't from Auckland. You went to see his parents on the South Island, did you say?
Yes, that's right. They're from Invercargill. So we spent some time in Invercargill, just outside Invercargill, a place called Riverton. And then we went up to Arrowtown, which is just outside Queenstown, which is one of my favourite cities in the entire world. And so we sort of spent most of our time between Arrowtown and Auckland. And we had a wonderful time.
So you wouldn't want to live there then, or you feel
would.
We
came back, and you know, we definitely obviously both our children are in education still. They're 14, and so we'd wait until they finished and then move at that point. And,
oh really?
So it's sort of pretty much, I wouldn't say concretized our idea, but it definitely gave us a goal to go for. You know, we would like to both.
And the kids liked it. The kids liked it down there.
Yes, they did. Well, you know, it's such a lovely lifestyle, and I think I'm not underestimating the difficulty of the transition for them when they've only lived in England. But like I say, with our daughter, we need to have a sense of community, which I don't really find in London that much. I think it's much more difficult to be in a bigger community. You know, I'd rather be in a smaller community where there is a sense of community. Although, you know, probably this coronavirus thing is going to change everything.
You mentioned that she has a disability. Is this something that she needs you with her all the time?
Yeah, she won't. It's a neurological. She has many neurological issues. You know, she has a developmental language disorder, amongst other things, and is profound. and attention deficits and. So there's a chance she won't be independent. So we need to frame our life around that to protect her, because we're older parents, you know. And so when, you know, when we get to the point, you know, she will need setting up in a situation where she can be safe and protected. So that's a lot of our, you know, raison d'etre, if you like.
So did she enjoy the different feel of New Zealand? Did she like the habitat, the nature? Does she enjoy that? Do both your kids enjoy that?
Yeah, she did. I mean, I think it's sort of, yes, I mean, it's a beautiful country. It's a lovely part of the world, and it's pretty special. I think because we had a basis of, obviously, Warwick has friends and family in the South Island, and I have my family and friends in the North Island, if you like. And so it was more about the people, because, you know, what we found was that there's a laid-back nature to New Zealanders and in the main, and a real naturalness to them. So they took on Clementine. You know, Clementine's behaviours are what reveal her. She has what's you describe as an invisible disability, and so it's more apparent by her behaviours. Where, and I think the English uptightness doesn't serve her well, if you like, because the reactions
are sort of embarrassing. That's hard for you. That's very hard for you. You must want to tell people,
yeah,
people things. Well, it can be very helpful.
It's sort of heartbreaking, but you know, it's also understandable, because the English by their nature are a lot more buttoned up and uptight, and they don't like variety. I think the looseness of, I'm talking very generally now, of you know, the nature of people I know in New Zealand, is they've just accepted her as she was. And so what happens is, with someone like Clementine, she seems to feed off that, and so her behaviours became less apparently aberrant, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, felt that nurture, she felt that love.
Yeah, and acceptance. You know, they don't really bat an eyelid about much, actually.
It must be the way of culture. So,
or maybe it's just my friends. Who knows?
You've got 30 girlfriends, and that you can just slot straight back in with them. And I presume they've got as well, have they?
Yeah, they didn't. You know, they've got families of their own now, and they're sort of in their teens and 20s. And, you know, there's this life there that sort of happened in parallel while I've not been there. And it was wonderful to connect up with them again and, you know, look forward to a place that, you know, we could settle in quite happily.
Brilliant. And tying things up now, Maria, before you escape, everybody that I interview on here, all fabulous women in their 50s, all with different challenges and different outlooks, but all sharing the same view, really, that being 50 is much younger than we think it is. There's lots to be positive about. We've probably got more confidence now than ever. How would you say your outlook has changed now compared to maybe when you were younger?
Okay. Well, I think everything gets better and better. I really do. You know, I'm more comfortable the older I get. I wasn't uncomfortable before. The thing about aging is, when you've been a model, is you become quite invisible. And I actually really quite like that. And the other thing, I don't think age is a barrier. I think it's an unnecessary barrier. And I think that it's a perception. You know, I've started a new, I'm back at college, I'm doing a diploma, I'm training as an early years practitioner, and I'm working in a nursery, and I've never been happier in a job.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, you know, I love the job, I love the people, it's like coming into my own, you know, I love the children, you know, the ages between 2 and 4 are developmentally very important, which I've been learning since I've had a daughter like my daughter, and it's just a real synthesis of everything that I've been learning and learned through having children, through, you know, a bit through my career. So I think, you know, everything can fall into place. I think it's a wonderful time, and I don't think there's a necessity to write anybody. You know, I'm at an age when I should be retiring now, and I'm starting again, and I don't really care, and I'm very, very happy with it. So, you know, I don't think it's necessary to be bound by a figure or a number.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is really what's behind the What the 50 podcast, because it's we're in a world where everybody talks about, you know, sexism or people's size or, you know, fatism or whatever they want to call it. I'm more interested in ageism, because it's almost like the invisible one that slipped through the PC net. It's almost like you're still, you know, expected to behave in a certain way, wear certain things and become invisible. But career-wise, I know for someone like yourself who's been a model, it's quite nice not to have the attention all the time. You were saying it's quite nice to be invisible in that way. But I'm saying it's you don't want to be invisible in the workplace. You want to still have aspirations and goals. And this is exactly what you're doing.
I totally agree. And I think that anything is possible. You know, I think that, you know, you might have to change your ideas because, you know, yes, there is ageism in the workplace without a doubt. You know, Warwick works in recruitment and there's a definite element of ageism in the workplace. But, you know, if you want to work in certain careers, there's not ageism. And if you want to set up your own thing, there's not ageism. You know, and I think people are a lot more inventive and entrepreneurial. And, you know, I think one of the outcomes of this terrible affliction that's going around the world is people will be thinking outside the box more because they'll have to. And I think that's all that happens as you get older. You know, you probably don't want to do the same things as you did in your 20s and 30s. I know I certainly don't. You know, I look at the models and I think, you know, great for you, but God no, not for me. And you know, where I'm at now, training up in this job, and it's actually a vocation and I love it. And I don't think there should be any barriers.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. So I think that you know, that is where we're at. You know, I don't think anyone needs to be bound by ageism, fatism, sexism, anything, you know, unless you want to be.
Any ism. You know. No isms, thank you. We don't want any more isms.
Yeah, quite right.
Absolutely. And just before you go, Maria, I have to ask you, any secrets to having fabulous skin? I mean, you were still modeling in your 50s. I should point that out, that your career has spanned all these decades. And you have recently given up. But to look great in your 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, whenever, have you got a particular routine, a diet, a favourite recipe, skincare, anything you can impart to our listeners of all walks of life?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think a lot of it is genetic. You know, my mother had very good skin. She, you know, I think aging, you know, I stayed out of the sun. One of the first jobs I ever did was with this makeup artist who'd been a very top model in the 60s. And she had skin like a 10-year-old and she was in her 30s. And, you know, in my 20s, that seemed quite old. And I was like, how come you've got this good skin? And she said she'd been a tea planter's daughter in India and they'd never put their face in the sun. So, you know, she did not have a line or a wrinkle on her. I mean, obviously she was only in her late 30s, but nothing, you know, she had a really very young looking skin.
And so I think a tea something daughter. What did you say she was? A something tea something daughter or
a tea planter's daughter?
A tea planter's daughter.
Yeah. So she'd grown up in India and she'd never had her face in the sun. Oh, have we finished?
Gosh,
I think we finished. Oh, okay. No, we're good. Okay, so something happened on my phone. So I thought, I'm never putting my face in the sun. So I never did. I just used to put fake tan. I'd tan my limbs, but I'd always put, you know, I'd hide my face from the sun always. And I think that helped. I think genetics helped.
I quite agree. I kept my face out the sun, and it is the first thing a makeup artist said to me as well, funnily enough. I wonder if it was the same one. I can't remember now. Similar conversation, but I think the sun is the skin killer and smoking.
Yeah. Probably. It's an ager, but I've never really eaten healthily, you know. And I remember when I was at university, I used to go to bed with my makeup on and wake up in the morning and think, oh, that looks really good. you know, I never really was terribly, you know, good about skincare routines. I do use that Boots thing, you know, that Protect and Perfect or whatever it is, and I think that's very good. But I never really went to town on, oh, I must do this, I must do that. I mean, if models had particularly good skin, I'd say, what do you use? And they would tell me and I would use it. But I think it's really about, photo aging and, mm-hmm. With the sun and, genetics. Yes, for sure, with lifestyle and eating and food, there's a lot you can do, but I didn't really, pay much attention to that myself.
It's a great tip, actually, for everyone out there, probably because we all know we've got to stay out the sun. We all know we shouldn't drink and smoke and we have to have diet and healthy lifestyle. But from what you're saying, you've broken all the rules apart from the sun one. So that's a fantastic way to end the show, Maria, because that gives us all hope that we can just be normal, have a great lifestyle. Otherwise, it's soul murder, isn't it? We might as well live and enjoy ourselves, but stay out.
Absolutely.
Back to 50 on and your big tea hat, your tea picking hat. Yeah. And enjoy it that way. Maria, it's been a complete joy speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Speak soon.
Great, Hazel. Take care. Bye.